the verb oida. Really, I was starting to work out on mental terms that Christians thinking processes, and been hung up on oida for quite some time. And we began with phroneo and the terms related to that, but we left that and moved into oida, because you begin someplace with some knowledge, some intuitive head knowledge. So that's where I've been working. And after dealing with phroneo for a little while, in some passages we found oida and gnosko together. We'll probably spend some time on gnosko, and I don't know that I plan to spend the next 10 years, if I'm still here, dealing with the mind terms, but we will be, anyway, that's where we are right now. And last week we looked at Colossians 4:6, and there it dealt with the Colossians dealing with their speech, and he told them that they were to let their speech at all times be with grace, but also it was to be seasoned with salt. And so that was the thing that we looked at last week. But the purpose was that you might know intuitively how to answer each man. And so when you come to each man, you need to watch your speech, though. And so you know how to give an answer. And there it is, an answer. The term that we would use that they used for answer. And then we, last week, when the internet failed, I went on to 2 Timothy chapter 2 and verse 23, and Paul's giving some admonition to Timothy personally, and he tells him about his speech, and when he did so, he said foolish or moronic, stupid kind of, and uneducated, we could say, paideia, with an alpha privative, paideia with an alpha, well, it's a verb, you know, it is a noun, but paideia with the verb, with the alpha privative, an unlearned, uneducated, undisciplined kind of speech, questioning. He uses the word questioning or debates. He says that they give birth to strife, it says in the AV. But the word strife there, makos, is, it gives birth to battles. And so I did spend some time last week going over and mentioned it. Those who were online missed it because I don't know what happened. Nobody knows what happened, I guess, but it went offline anyway. But we did go over to refer over to James chapter 4. And so we're going to be moving over to James chapter 4 because we do have an oida in the context. And this is a context that Chris has worked some, and he dealing with the world system. And so we're going to be looking at friendship with the world, with the world system, and what happens with when you're a friend of the world. But we begin, we're going to pick up verses in chapter 4, verses 1 through 4. We're going to be looking at the first four verses there. And we will be considering the oida down there, but there's a context that leads into the friendship with the world system. Now, when we come to James, James is writing in chapter 1, verse 1, to the 12 tribes that are scattered. And so he's writing to 12 tribes. Now, he is James. We know that this is James, the Lord's half-brother, who writes this. And so he was with the Lord. And when he writes, it's the most Jewish of the epistles. An awful lot of influence. You can see his Jewish influence. This is in the transitional period that he writes, and it's fairly early, and he hasn't been exposed to a lot, but he is a Christian. He's writing to Christians. And so he's writing to those who belong to the Church of God when he writes. And so he's a member of the Church of God. But he writes, and he has a lot of Jewish influence in the book, as to phrases and words that he uses that are pretty much predominant in James. When you look at James, he does use that kind of speech. Now James himself, When he was saved, he became part of the church. I mean, he became a leader in the church in Jerusalem. So Paul, when he went up from Damascus to Jerusalem the first time, what does he find? He visits Peter, and then he visits James, the Lord's brother. And so they were the two who were still there. The church had been driven out by around the stoning of Stephen by Saul of Tarsus. And so they were driven out of Jerusalem, and there weren't many left in Jerusalem except the apostles. But when Paul goes up himself as Saul of Tarsus, he does meet with Peter and James. But then over in chapter 2 and verse 9, he goes back up, and after he's been ministering, he wants to make sure concerning his ministry that he's doing what he ought to be doing. And so it was determined that Peter was the apostle. He dealt with the Jews, and Paul's ministry was more to the Gentiles, though both of them dealt with the others as well. But when you look at Galatians 2:9, it does tell us that James, Cephas, that is Peter, and John, he says they seem to be the pillars of the church in Jerusalem. And so the pillars, they were outstanding ones in the church in Jerusalem who were the support there. And so they were the leaders in the church. But we find James being the one who seems to be the leader in the church in Jerusalem. Now, if we go over to Acts 15, we find that James is referred to. Peter goes to the... Every time somebody comes from James, they try to go back under law. And that happened to Galatians because Peter had to rebuke Barnabas because he was drawn away when some came down from Jerusalem, up from Jerusalem from James. And so he went and separated from the Jews. Well, he had to, that was an influence there. Now in Acts 15, there were some who came down from Jerusalem, and they were saying that at the Gentiles, they needed to be circumcised. I don't believe they're saying to be saved with initial salvation, but to be saved in their present tense salvation, they had to be circumcised like the Jews were. And so this created a conflict up in Antioch on the up in Syria on the Orontes River. It created some turmoil, and so there was quite a dispute. So Paul, and Barnabas, they go down to Jerusalem with these individuals, and they meet with the church there. And there were some who were zealots for the law still there. There were some Pharisees who had been saved, but they still wanted to go back and live under rules, under the law. And so they were highly influenced. Well, James kind of fit into that circle at that time. But Peter, he talks about how God had done the same thing for the Gentiles that he had, when he went up to Cornelius' household. He tells them that the same thing happened there to the Jews that happened to the Gentiles that happened to the Jews on the day of Pentecost. And so the Holy Spirit came upon them. They were saved in the same way. And in fact, he says that we shall be saved the same way they will be in the end of his statement there. But then he goes on, and as he spoke about these things, James picks it up, and he says, as Cephas, as Peter said, he goes on to describe what Peter said. And we might just take a look back there for a moment, and Acts chapter 15, and I just want to point out verses that deal with this in verse 13. And after they had held their peace, James answered, saying, "Men and brethren, hearken unto me." So they were silent, and he says, "Listen to me." And notice what he says: "Simeon hath declared how God, rather than at the first, but for the first time, did visit any Gentiles, a quality of Gentiles, to take out from them a people for his name." And so God did something with the Gentiles through Peter when he went to the household of Cornelius and back in Acts chapter 10. And then now they're up in Antioch on the city Orontes River. And so that's where we find them there. But he says, this was the first time, and to this they agree the words of the prophet, says it stands written. And when he says after this, he goes back to Amos 9, 11, and 12, but after this, Amos doesn't say after this, but this is something James says by, as he's referring back to the Old Testament, to something that would take place. But he says it's after this, after God has taken out a people for his name from the Gentiles. After this, he says. Then he says, after this, he says, I will return. God says, I will return and will build again the tent of David, which has fallen down, and I will build again the ruins therefrom, and I will set it up, that the residue of men, and so I believe here he's referring to the Jews when he speaks of the residue of men might seek after the Lord, and all the Gentiles, now the Gentiles upon whom my name is called, saith the Lord, who doeth all these things, and so forth. But you notice, James, he gets a little bit of distinctive truth here. But he wasn't up to speed all the way. He still, has a lot of Jewish background that he carries with him, like a lot of the early church did. And so he had to be transitioned and he had to be weaned away from where he was. And when he writes to these individuals, these of the 12 tribes, he is writing to 12 tribes, and they are dispersed around. And let's go back to Acts 11 for just a moment and look at the readers and that he's writing to when we get to chapter 4. But in 11:19, he says, now they which were scattered abroad upon the persecution that arose about Stephen traveled as far as Phenice and Cyprus and Antioch, preaching the word to none but unto the Jews only. And so they kept their ministry to the Jews, and some of them were men of Cyprus and Cyrene, which when they were come to Antioch, spake unto the Grecians, preaching the Lord Jesus. And so, but you see, there were those who were scattered abroad, and it's likely these are the ones who James is writing to, but they've been scattered abroad, pushed out of Jerusalem, and they have had to flee. And so they are scattered though, as he writes to them. I believe he wrote this early, and it could have been any place from 45, 46, AD. It could have been any place back in there. It could have been probably not beyond 50 AD that he wrote. It's very possible, and it's probable that this was the first of the epistles to be written. But as we come to James, then, just a little background there, as he's writing to Jewish believers, as he writes this, he's not emphasizing the Gentiles here, but he's writing to those who are Jewish Christians. Their background, they were born Jews, but now they're part of the Church of God. And in God's sight, they're no longer Jews, just as Gentiles in the church are no longer Gentiles in God's eyes, but the new race, the Church of God. And so that's who he writes to. Now, if you will, turn with me over to James, and we want to begin, and we'll be looking at, as I said, verses 1 through 4 is as far as we'll get, I hope. I want to just pick up the immediate context, the preceding context for just a moment, and just point a few things out before we get into chapter 4. I'm going to look at verse 15 first of all. Now when James writes, he doesn't really have a steady flow. He moves from subject to subject. It is kind of a difficult book to outline in some ways, different than many approaches. Some have many breakdowns in their outlines of James. But we'll pick up in where I said in verse 15. He says, this wisdom descendeth not from above, but is earthly. And so it's sensual, it's soulish. And so it's just the word soulish. It's demon-like kind of wisdom, the kind of wisdom that he's spoken of in some of the issues above. They had different, they had works from the flesh and other things in the preceding context, as well as influence from Satan and so forth. But he goes on in verse 16, for where envyings and strife is, and strife is erethia, where selfish ambition is, he says, and work of the flesh, and envying is zeal, work of the flesh, I didn't mention that, but is there is there is confusion, and so it's there. It becomes a tumultuous thing in every evil work, and so it's. But the wisdom that is from above, he goes on to describe. It's, he says it is first pure and peaceable, gentle. I'm not going to translate all these. I'm just going to read through it. But and easy to be entreated, full of mercy and good fruits, without partiality and without hypocrisy. Now notice verse 18, and the fruit from righteousness is sown in peace. And so righteousness, there can be a product, a produce from righteousness, but it's sown in peace. And it's sown in peace by those that are that make peace. And so that's leading into chapter 4. He speaks of those who are peaceable. Those who are peaceable, and so that moves right into chapter 4, where all of a sudden now we come into conflict, and he jumps right into conflict. Now, in the early church, there were they had battles that went on within the early church between believers down through time. People's natures haven't changed, and people still there are still conflicts within churches, and so you can have things that ought not to be. That take place, but it's and he's going to deal with some of those things because some of his readers, they have there is some problem, and so you notice as he begins in verse one, we see the source of various conflicts that arise amongst James's readers, but he says, "From whence come wars?" So where do wars come from? Whence are wars? And do you? He uses an adverb looking at where they come from. Where do they come from? What's the source of wars and what's the source of fightings? Now, if you look at a critical text, it will have a repeat of the word, the adverb, whence. And the AV, the King James translates it. They actually translate it once, but in the critical text it occurs twice, but it does occur twice, and either way, the question carries over, and it's an interrogative adverb here, whence, from where come wars, and from where do come fightings, battles. Now, I'm going to look at those two terms of wars and battles for a moment. This is a place where you can come to see the different the contrast between different kinds of conflict that takes place. And so this verse 1 gives you three different words that deal with different types of battle and different kinds of warfare. And so the first term, though, the word translated wars, polemos, it has the idea of a campaign. So this is a major campaign. And so we'll look at a couple of examples of this back in Matthew chapter 24. I guess we just quoted, but we won't. But Matthew 24 and verse 6. Now, before the Lord returns, and they're going to hear things before the tribulation period and such, but it says in Matthew 24, 6, and you shall hear of wars. You'll hear concerning wars and rumors concerning wars. And so they're going to hear about wars and rumors of wars. So it's going to be a lot of conflict at this time when it comes down to the Lord's answering the disciples' questions. We can't go into that context here, but it's wars. Now, I have some other good examples over in the book of Revelation. And we'll look at Revelation chapter 12. And as we look at 12, we'll look at verse 7. You have this great red dragon who's identified, mentioned in verse 4. We find his identity in verse 9, that he's the great dragon. He was the old serpent called the devil and Satan. So he's the one that's cast out of heaven and his angels with him. But notice in verse 7, and there was war. This is the same word, polemos. This was a war. This was a big war. This was a campaign. And so in heaven, Michael and his angels fought against the dragon, and the dragon fought against his angels. And so you had this, this war, but it's a war. And so it's a campaign. Over to chapter 16 and verse 14. And this is dealing with the sixth vial. The angel that dumps out the sixth vial, you have these spirits, these unclean spirits in verse 13 who look like they have appearance similar to frogs that come out from the Euphrates. But as you move down to verse 14, for they are spirits, that is demons, working sign miracles. The word miracles here is sign miracles, which go forth unto the kings of the earth and of the whole earth world. But what do they go forth to do? They go to gather them to the battle of the great day of God Almighty, to the war, to the campaign. And this is a big war. And so this is going to be a great campaign, a great war. And so we speak of wars. We speak of World War I, World War II. This would be on that level. We speak of the Civil War, and so that's it's a war, and it's a big campaign. It takes place in a lot of places, and so that's the kind of word the wars are. Well, he says, where do the wars come from? And then in James 4:1, he said, from the fightings. The word fightings here is the same word we saw in 2 Timothy 2:23, battles. And so this looks at the individual battles. Where do they come from? And so we'll take a look at some references dealing with the battles. In 2 Corinthians chapter 7 and verse 5, Paul said outside, he'd been waiting for Titus to come, and when Titus came, that was a good thing. But he said outside, outside, exterior, there were battles, this term is used. And so there were battles, individual battles. And within, he says, inside of him, there were fears. And so there are those kinds of thoughts, but these are battles, not the big campaign. But where do they come from? The battles that take place. He's going to identify where they come from. We noticed this word already referenced to 2 Timothy 2:23, that some kinds of speech, they give birth to battles. So they don't want these kinds of things. In Titus 3:9, they battled over law, and battles about the law, though. And you do have a verbal form giving this idea. I won't go back there for time, but in the Gospel of John, of John 6:52, you find the Jews striving, they're battling with one another over what the Lord Jesus is saying. So they're in battle. They're not throwing punches or shooting at each other, but they're battling. And these would be words, battles. In fact, in the pastorals, it is used with battles. It's word battles. So they could have those kinds of battles. But they would fight. It's used in Acts 7:26, where we see when Moses, after he had slain the Egyptian who was beating on the two Jews, when the Jews were fighting each other, they were fighting. They were battling. So there was a battle. It probably was a physical battle going on, but it's a battle. And so it wasn't a major campaign, but it was a battle going on. And so in 2 Timothy 2:24, it went on when Paul told Timothy that some kinds of questions, they do give rise, they give birth to battles. He said that a servant of the Lord must not strive, he must not do battles. Not to get involved in battles. And so there were
they had problems. There are problems in churches today where you do have battles, but you also can have campaigns where you have different sides taken and such, but then they can end up in battles. And then those can end up in something else, but we'll go back and we'll pick up that last word in a minute. Now, when you look down at the, so go back to James 4 and verse 1, he's going to answer this question. So he uses adverbs, interrogative adverbs, the first one, in the first two instances. If we take two of them, as the critical text does, it says pathen. Pathen, just listen to the word that he uses there. But then as he goes on to the next thing to give his answer, he uses and to then. Let's see, there's a then. That's just a review. Anyway, but then means whence, from whence, comes from someplace. And so he moves on to describe where these things come from. And so he asks the question again with another interrogative adverb. Are they not out from, and what he says here, are they not out from your, it says lusts. Now, the word lust, I would translate that differently. You do have the word for lust coming up in the next verse. So it's not lust here, but it's Eden. We get our word hedonism from it. And so I have a center column that says pleasures. And so these would be pleasures that, things that would be, these would be more of a selfish kind of a strong desire for pleasure. It's all very selfish, kind of a concept with the hedonisms. And so it's something that just seeks pleasure that pleases the individual or the party or whatever. But it's something that's very pleasing, kind of a thing, but it's and that's how some would translate that as pleasing. But are they not from hence, from here? Don't they come from here? By the way, he asked that question, don't they come from here? He says, yes, they do. And so it requires a positive answer, the way that he asks this question. It demands a positive answer, and yes, they do come from pleasures, from hedonisms. But where do these hedonisms, what do they do? He says, and there you have the word war in English again, in your members. Now, the word war is a different term. This is waging a limited warfare, a limited battle, kind of a thing. It comes from the word for soldier, and there are several different forms of it. It doesn't occur a whole lot, but it does have to do with what we might call skirmishes. And so there's a skirmishing that goes on within the war and the battles. And so when you look at this, in 2 Corinthians, I'm going to give you a couple of places where it speaks of this term. In 2 Corinthians 10:3, he says, we do not war, limited warfare against the flesh. And so Paul says, 1 Timothy 1:18, he says that you might war, that you might wage a limited warfare. And what he says there, he just tells Timothy that you might have a good limited warfare. You might have a warfare fighting against the proper things there. But then in 2 Timothy 2:4, he describes a soldier going forth to war. And so when a soldier goes forth to war, he doesn't get all tied up in all of the affairs around a battle. He doesn't go down and do his business dealings and then go out and fight some more. He leaves everything behind. He doesn't get entangled with all of the affairs that would tie him down at home. He goes out and he's committed to the war, so he wages a limited warfare. He doesn't get entangled in what he's doing in his daily affairs. And so he has to, he doesn't get all tangled up anyway so that he can't fight the limited warfare when he has to go to war. 1 Peter 2:11, and let's do take a look at that in James 4 so we can go over to 1 Peter, page over. And this is a verse we come to when it deals with the flesh. And so where does this flesh, how does it wage limited warfare? He says, "Dearly beloved, I beseech you as strangers and pilgrims, abstain from fleshly strong desires." And so these are the lusts. This is the word epithumeo, or epithumia in the noun, but it's these from fleshly lusts which wage a limited warfare where against the soul. And so, as we always say, the soul is the weak point when it comes to the flesh that attacks through the soul. And so when a lust comes from the flesh, from within us, it works on our soul. It's not a rational thing to get involved with the works of the flesh, but it comes from the soul. And it wages a limited warfare within us. Now, let's just pause for just a moment. And as we consider these terms, and then we'll move on. So we have a campaign that's going on. And so you could compare that with a civil war. Last week, we just talked about it, World War II and the Battle of the Bulge. But let's just consider the Civil War. That's your campaign. That's the big war. Then you look at the next term of the battles. This would be the Battle of Gettysburg, say. And there were a lot of battles, a lot of different battles within the Civil War. But that would be limited down to Gettysburg and the battle that went on there. Now, within that battle, you had various skirmishes that took place. And that would be something like maybe General Pickett's charge would be a skirmish that took on. You had skirmishes going on, a little round top. You could go through. There were skirmishes going on throughout the battle that was taking place there. Gives you some idea, though, as he uses these terms, there is warfare that can go on, and he's warning he's addressing these right readers of the 12 tribes. As he writes to them, he's describing how they there are wars. Where do they come from? Where does all this campaign go that ends up in smaller battles, maybe between sides here and there, and then it ends up to be a skirmish that takes place and maybe more individually, but whatever, you have conflict. And so the whole picture here is, where do these things come from? Well, he says, don't they come from your hedonisms, your pleasures, and the ones that are waging a limited warfare, skirmishing, and he goes on to say, in your members. And so where does it come from? Well, it comes, wars start with the individual. And so it comes down to what's within your members. How do you use your members? And so you want something for your pleasure. Well, that leads to war. Most of your wars start because somebody wants something somebody else has for their good, for their pleasure, whatever. They're out to get it. And so they end up in conflict. And so you have different forms of conflict. Well, this was a problem that James addresses, and he uses some pretty strong terms to describe where do these things come from. Well, they do come from your lusts, and that's and he expects a positive answer that yes, they do come from your hedonisms, from your pleasure, seeking pleasure, your pleasures. Now he goes on in verse 2, and verses 2 and 3, you have a number of things that are unachieved by his readers. They have some unachieved quests here as they seek some things. He says, you lust now. Now he uses the word epithumeo here, you do lust. And so you strongly desire. And remember, lust is used in a good sense and a bad sense also. Mostly we do find it in a bad sense, but it also occurs in a good sense. Depends on the context. And your hedonisms, that's all used in a bad sense. And we don't find a verb for it in the New Testament. And so you don't find the verb for hedonisms, but you do have the word for lust here. And so this is stretch yourself out for the office of a bishop, you strongly desire, you lust for a good thing. So see, it's good there. Paul said to depart and to be with Christ. He said he had a strong desire for that. That was a good kind of a thing. But this is used in a negative sense, obviously. You lust. And so you strongly desire.
and you don't have. And so they would put themselves out for things. They want things. They have this strong desire to have things within them, but he says, yet you don't have. And so there's a couple times here he'll say, they don't have, you don't have. But he says you kill. And the word kill here would be murder. And so they're involved. He says you murder. Now, whether they actually were murdering each other, that's kind of questionable for sure, whether they actually, they'd end up being executed by the civil authorities probably if they got caught in murder. They didn't have the forensics we have today, but they'd probably still catch them maybe. But he says that you find in 1 John chapter 4, and it's around verse 19, or if I have to get, no, it's not 1 John, in 3:15, I made a note there, but anyway, he says if a man hates his brother, if you should happen to hate your brother, he says you're a murderer. And so just the hatred, he'd like to see his brother dead. He says you're equivalent to a murderer. Well, sometimes when people murder, it's because they want something. They want it pretty badly. Now, usually if there's a murder and they're not sure who did it or whatever, just check and see who has their life insurance policy, if it's close. Anyway, that was, but anyway, the word murder here, I'm not so sure that they actually were physically murdering. But he says you do this, and that's what they would do if they had opportunity. And he's going to bring up the warfare again in the next, as we move on. But he says you murder. He says you, when it says you desire to have, really it's you are zealous to have. And so they're zealous. Now that this comes out of the zeal as part of the works from the flesh, one of the works from the flesh. And so they're zealous. And so it's not so much that they really have to have it, but they would like to have it, but they don't want the other person to have an advantage or to have some success in what they do. They want to kind of keep the other person down. And so that leads to conflict. Again, if you have zeal, evident zeal, work of the flesh, it can lead to these kinds of conflicts that he describes in the context here. And so you do have quite a string of things here, but he says you are zealous to have and you cannot obtain. And so they're zealous, but they really can't get what they want. And so they're in conflict, they're in campaigning, they're battling, they're skirmishing, whatever, trying to get their pleasures because it comes from their pleasures that they want. And so they do that as they go. But they can't obtain. And so that if you don't get what you're trying to get, you're going to keep trying to get it, I'm sure. And so it led to continuation of these conflicts that were going on that he writes about here. And these kind of things, they do take place in churches even today. And it's a sad thing, but they do. Man's nature hasn't changed, like we say. But he goes on to say, you fight, and so he says you battle and you wage campaigns, yet you have not, you don't have. And so he said it here, you don't have. You want it, you lust for it, but you can't get it, you can't obtain it. They're zealous, they can't obtain, but you don't have what you want. And so you have not because you ask not, he says. And so the reason they don't have is they don't ask. Now, this is usually in the middle voice. We'll have it in the active voice in the next verse. But this is, this is an asking of a lesser to a greater. That's the way that we ask. And so, but it's a middle voice. You ask for yourself. And so you have not because you don't ask for yourself. Now, he's not saying that you should ask for your pleasures, for your hedonisms, that you're not able to, things you strongly desire. He's not condoning that and saying, well, if you just ask for them, you'd get them. But they are not asking. And when they do ask, but some do ask, he goes on to say in the next verse, you are asking, and that's an active voice. They were. Some did ask. Maybe some didn't. Some says you don't ask. but they're not asking properly. He says, you are asking and you receive not. And so they receive not. They don't get what they're asking for. The problem is, moving on over to the causal clause, because you are asking for yourselves, it says amiss. It's a little stronger than that. It's kakos. It's an adverb that has the idea of lacking in character. Kakos would be lacking in character. Something that's bad. You ask badly. You ask in a manner that's lacking in character. And so that's the way they're asking. It's lacking in character, not asking as they ought to. And again, their asking comes from, they're asking for what? The things that would give them pleasure, their pleasures. And so they end up in these battles, these conflicts, various forms of conflict, because they are not getting what they want. And so they're asking in a bad manner, though, that you may consume it upon your lusts. And there the word lusts again is hedonisms, your pleasures. And so they're asking in such a way that they may, when it says consume, it's just a word to spend something. And so it has the idea here of squandering, that you might squander it. And so you're asking so that you might just squander whatever you're asking for upon your own lusts. Well, they're not getting it, because then they're not able to receive it, because they're asking in a selfish way for selfish things that pertain to their selfish desires for inner pleasure. Whatever they're wanting, they ask for it. But these things do involve the conflicts that are mentioned above. Now we move on down to verse 4, and verse 4 is where we come to the term oida, and so this is why we're looking at this. But he says, you adulterers and adulteresses. And when he says you adulterers and adulteresses, you do find this, that the, in the majority of text, about the only one in a, that reads adulterers, and it doesn't matter whether it's there or not, I don't, but it, most of your manuscripts do leave adulterers out, but it makes the male want somebody. But the adultery, what's adultery? Well, it does, whether it's listed at the beginning of the works of the flesh in Galatians 5:19 or not, I would leave it there probably, but it does have to do with sexual immorality, and so it does have to do with fornication. It could be inclusive in fornication, but this is done in marriage. And so he addresses them as adulterers and adulteresses, or just adulteresses, if we leave it the way that the critical text reads it. Now, earlier, you can just glance across the page over in my Bible anyway, to chapter 3 and verse 1. Notice how he addresses them, my brethren. And so they're my brethren, my brothers. And so now he gets pretty harsh with his terminology here, with these who are in conflict. But now this conflict is relative to the world system. So I come to one of Chris's verses. I should just let him come up and finish it. But anyway, this is we're dealing with the world system in this verse, though, and the world system, it's an enemy, it's not a friend. And so as we look at it, just look at verse 4. It says you, if you leave adulterers or adulteresses, it's very similar in the Old Testament. You often find Israel and their idolatry. They were referred to as adulteresses, and they were an adulterous nation. They were not to have any gods above Jehovah upon their idol shelf, and yet they consistently would go off and chase idols, and they would get involved with idol worship and idols. And so this was something they did a lot of when it came down to their activity. God sees them as his wife in the Old Testament. He wrote her a bill of divorcement. He will take her back again. But at the present, she's She's seen as an adulterous wife who's been divorced, but God will take her back. And so that's pretty clear in the prophets. And when he speaks of adulterers and adulteresses here, I don't think he's speaking in the physical sense of adultery in any sense here. He's using it of spiritual adultery. And I believe that from the rest of the verse, because he's going to describe, he's going to ask them a question about friendship here. And so that's where we come to Oida in the verse anyway. And he says, I still stick into the reading in the King James, but you adulterers and adulteresses, don't you know that friendship with reference to the world is enmity with reference to God? Don't you know that? Well, when he asked that question, if you were to look at it in the Greek, it says, yes, you do. You know this. He's telling them something they know. And so they know that friendship with the world is enmity, it's hatred with God. And so that's something that he addresses here, though concerning their relationship to the world. And so don't you know that philia, friendship, this is just like Philadelphia, brotherly fondness, not brotherly love, but this is more of an emotional kind. If you want to use the word love, this would be an emotional kind of love where there's feelings that are more expressed than agape. Now, 1 John 2, of course, has been there in verse 15 and 16, but in verse 15, you're to stop loving the world, and you're also to stop loving the things that are in the world. Now, that's agape, and so a spirit-filled believer he could misdirect his love, his agape love. It's a possibility. And so you may be spirit-filled, you may be loving, but who are you supposed to love? One another. So we go back to the new commandment, you love one another as I have loved you. And so you go back there, that's where if you're loving the world, the love for the Father, the love concerning the Father is not in you. And so you can't love the world and the Father at the same time. And so what does James say? Well, he uses the word fondness here. If you're a friend of the world, then he says friendship with the world is enmity. It's hatred with reference to God. Don't you know that? Yeah, you know that. And so you don't want to be a friend of the world. And if you are a friend of the world, I would see in my understanding is when you go to 1 John 2:15, stop loving. If you're loving the world and you keep loving, you're not going to be loving it with agape love for long. Pretty soon it's going to degenerate into just a feeling and an emotional kind of a love. And so you can become very fond of the world. And so that fondness, he says, don't you know that it's enmity, it's hatred with God? And so you're really directing hatred towards God when you're loving the world with this kind of a friendship. And so they did translate it friendship, which was good, but it's enmity with God. Need to cover the last phrase here. He says, whosoever therefore determines to be a friend. And so they did friend here, see, and so it's but it is a friendly kind of a feeling kind of a thing when you're a friend, but it is more of involves friendship and feeling. But he says, whoever therefore, when it says will, it's bulamai, it's to determine. Whoever determines, if you're determining to be a friend with reference to the world, now it says, is the enemy of God. Not a good translation. It's not that you are an enemy of God. But when we read that, it says, if you determine to be a friend with reference to the world, the word is not a normal to be verb. You constitute yourself to be an enemy with reference to God. Pertaining to God, and so you become an enemy, one who's a real enemy of God. If you're making yourself to be. Now let me just look at it the other way. The way he says it is very carefully expressed here. that you constitute yourself to be. And it would be a middle voice. You constitute yourself to be. I wouldn't take it as a passive. God doesn't count you an enemy, but you are constitute yourself to be an enemy of God. And so if you're God's, but God doesn't count you to be an enemy. You're still a child. You're still a son of God in Christ. You still have your salvation, but in your present tense salvation, as far as you're concerned, you're misdirecting your love, but you're also now your friend. And so you're friendly here with the world, and this is your good friend. So now you constitute yourself into be an enemy of God because you're not directing. You're not a friend of God at that point. Neither are you directing agape love for sure too. But you don't have that relationship with God that you can. But it's you. You're the one who's doing it. And I would take it as I said, as a middle voice. You constitute yourself to be an enemy of God. And so not a good picture, but he says, don't you know this? Don't you people who are spiritual adulteresses, those who are being friends with the world system? And so we all live in the world system. Chris has been dealing with that in the afternoons, dealing with the world system. It is a very subtle, very real enemy. And so we're surrounded by it. We live in it. We're not of it. We can use it, but we just don't use it up to the fullest. We're not to love it. But yet we do, we're in this world. But you don't want to become a friend of the world. You live in it. And remember, this earth isn't our home. And the world system, we don't belong to it. We're not out from it anymore. And so we don't have to be too wrapped up in the world system. And yet we're surrounded by it, but just use it, but don't use it up to the fullest, but don't make it a friend. And it's easy for Christians to do that. If you're a friend of the world, then you're making yourself an enemy of God, though you're constituting yourself an enemy. And also, when you're misdirecting your love in that way, what happens, there can be conflicts. And so these kind of things are, you want things in the world system will work on you and work through in you. It'll work on you. And you can end up with conflicts between believers. And then, so these things ought not to be. They do happen, but they ought not to happen in amongst grace believers. And so James, he writes some very practical things here dealing with believers. The 12 tribes who are spread abroad, and yet as he writes to those, what he writes to them, we do have the same kind of circumstances today in many of the things that he writes about. So there are things to take to heart and to think about. Just don't be a friend of the world and don't be involved trying to feed your hedonisms and getting involved with conflicts, different kinds. Father, we're thankful for your word and thankful again that it is practical, but it is your word and is true. And as we look at these things, and we all have the same nature these Jews did, again, might we be in tune to the Spirit, and when it comes to the world, might we see it as an enemy and be living in it as those who are just pilgrims and strangers just passing through as we are heading on to heaven. And so we're thankful for the prospects before us, but again, might we not be encumbered by the affairs of this world so much that it distracts from our relationship on a personal daily level with you. And we'd be grateful for that. Amen.